This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We talk a lot about Southern food and what it means, how it has become a touchstone for identity, and how that food sets us apart from the rest of the country. We've also talked about the origins of Southern cuisine. Well, now cultural and culinary historian Michael Twitty has added to the topic by traveling back in time. He can trace his own family back to 1624 North Carolina, and he has both black and white members of that family. His research into Southern cuisine is navigated through the wilds of something else we've had to contend with in the South and around the country, race. Twitty's research suggests that racial healing may come from embracing the discomfort of our past and the possibility that food has the power to bring us together. Michael Twitty's new book is called The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. And Michael Twitty joins us now for the hour. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us in our Spirit Square studio, Kathleen Purvis, longtime food editor for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Oh, let me find a microphone for you. There you go. Good morning.
Well, yeah, some people try and turn my microphone off all the time, Mike.
Well, not at the start. And Chef Matthew Krenz is with us. He's the executive chef at the Asbury in the Dunhill Hotel, who says he's been influenced by Michael Twitty.
Morning. Morning.
How so?
I was fortunate enough to see him speak last year, and his conversation and the way that he approaches this subject is just second to none. And starting the conversation through food is a special thing for me.
Well, we'll talk about that as we go through the program. Welcome to you all. Michael Twitty will be joining Chef Krenz, as a matter of fact, at the Asbury tonight for the final collaborative series dinner of the year. Unfortunately, for those of you listening who do not have reservations, you can't get in because it is sold out. But you can still go to our website and check it out if you'd like to at WFAE.org. Aside from your book, Michael, and your status as a culinary and cultural historian, you are also a noted blogger. You've been called one of the 20 greatest food bloggers of all time. Southern Living says you are one of the 50 people who are changing the South. Was that your intent?
No, I just wanted to cook some food and tell my grandmother's stories, really.
Does any of that surprise you?
You know something? To sort of like get into the pages of Garden and Gun, to get in the pages of Southern Living, to, you know, do a TED Talk, to be a part of the interpretation at Colonial Williamsburg. These are institutions that, you know, haven't, you know, some have, but many have not always been the voice for African-American Southerners. And to have that opportunity to be engaged in that way, to groundbreak. I have my Jackie Robinson moment, you know, every time those things happen. So it's just a plus.
You're still a young guy, so I'm looking back on this. It hasn't, I guess this has all come relatively quickly for you. Does it
20 years is
well, 20 years is not, yeah. I've been doing this for a long time. so 20 years is a blink of an eye, but when you look back on it, I'm not sure what the question is. It just seems like a lot to have happen for somebody who didn't necessarily set their sights on all these things. How did that happen? When did you become aware of the fact that you were making waves?
I think it was before Paula Deen. You know, everybody always references the Paula Deen incident where she's, you know, was on trial and things were coming out about her. And I took my sweet time. I mean, I was 10 days in to the story, which in social media terms is forever. And next thing I know, I challenged this idea that the story was about Paula Deen saying the N-word. And I said, the story is about the fact that you're focusing all the attention of Southern food on this one person, on a single narrative, without talking about the diversity of Southern food in the presence of black cooks. For a lot of people, that opened their eyes to my work. But the reality is, since I started blogging, my emphasis has always been on the people, not the food. The food is important, but recipes are never as more important than human lives. Mm. So I want to emphasize the fact that we had all these invisible lives and invisible contributors to the story of Southern cooking that weren't getting attention because people were so focused on, you know, making an idol of recipes and food and a whole, you know, food porn culture. They were ignoring the fact that we had millions of human beings, black, white, native, et cetera, who lived and died in poverty but created the food that is a billion-dollar industry today.
Wow. Am I wrong? Did you ask Paula Deen to sit down and have a conversation?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it was in North Carolina. I did a dinner at Stagville Plantation in Durham. Uh-huh. And I invited her and didn't hear back. And it was a total olive branch. But looking back on it, I'm actually cool about this, because it would have been about Paula and not about the fact that we brought people together of every different background, right, in the space of former slave quarters, living a dream our ancestors could never have realized.
So to this day, you've never spoken?
Nah. Okay. No, I haven't heard from her.
You can try.
Drop me a line, Paula.
Her son's been on this program. He sat over there. You can trace your history back to 1624.
Slight correction, 1674, but yes, sir.
Okay, 74, okay. Well,
yes, sir.
Maybe my vision is not what it used to be.
You're good, you're good.
That's a long time. 1674, that's still a long time ago.
Yeah.
And you have both black and white ancestors.
Yes, and so native and all the color above.
So when you go back to 1674, who are those people?
So the quick version is that was... one of my European lines. That was the Bellamy family and the Crowles. And some of them drifted down to North Carolina after being in the Massachusetts Bay Colony right after the first Thanksgiving. So they were Bradfords as well. Some of them were Lathrops. I'm basically Sarah Palin and her cousin. Yeah. Hi, cousin Sarah. But from New England, they drifted down to New Jersey, to North Carolina, and others just came straight to the Carolina colony. So not long after 1670, when the Carolina Proprietary Colony was established,
yeah,
I had people here.
So when did the other side of the family arrive?
So my enslaved African ancestors were drifted in through Virginia and South Carolina starting in the mid-1600s. Wow. They were probably some of the first waves from Central Africa, and then later on, they're predominantly showing up between 1710, my best guess, and as late as 1810.
So how did you do this? How did you trace it back?
Carefully.
Don't say Ancestry.com, but no, you can if you want.
It was part of it, but I mean, even then, you know, like you said, you know, there's these popular services that are available. The problem is that for African Americans, there will always be those brick walls.
Right.
But for me, it was an issue of, If you looked at the story of the food, you know, there's periodization, there's migrations, there are things, there's all this context you have to be aware of. When you look back at the genealogy and you go, okay, so I did this, I did 14 or 15 DNA tests through me and my rest of my family, my grandfather, my maternal uncle, various distant cousins who were on direct bloodlines. So I was able to determine what our admixtures were, what specific African ethnic groups we came from, and then you work backwards and you say, when did that group show up? There are all these statistics about the slave trade, and so once you go back and make the connections, you're able to kind of figure out when and where people enter the American story. And I figure if we can do that, we can also begin to tell the story of how Southern food itself developed based on having that same family tree.
In the opening sentence of your book, you say the Old South is a place where people use food to tell themselves who they are, to tell others who they are, and to tell stories about where they've been. But you also say in the book that when it comes to Southern food, part of the conversation has always been who owns it. And by that, I guess you mean which race.
Mm-hmm.
So what conclusion have you arrived at?
Well, I think one of the major problems that we've had is that white Southerners have often being seen as the gatekeepers of Southern identity. And the problem with that is that white Southerners are not the only Southerners. On the flip side, in terms of ownership, I think who owns Southern food, the answer is very simple. Whoever takes responsibility for its future and owns its past. If you don't do both of those things and, you know, have a forward-thinking, progressive present, where you understand the complexity and think critically about it, then, you know, you don't own it.
Because you said in the book, they took our names, meaning that the slave owners, when mm-hmm. when the Africans arrived, they renamed them, as
right.
happened to Kunta Kinte in the in Roots. They took our gods, they took our religion, but they didn't take our food.
Right.
But didn't they for a long time?
So the food was actually co-opted immediately because they're cooking for themselves and for their slaveholders. And so it was just like, okay, if you're in Jamaica, if you're in the Low Country, you're in Tidewater, Virginia, and you no longer have access to skirret and meddlers.
I beg your pardon?
Yeah, skirret and meddlers and currants and cardoons. You know, all these European medieval foods that people had eaten for centuries. But now you have to eat corn, beans, and squash, okra, watermelon, rice, and tomatoes. You're not in your world anymore.
Right.
So you're going to eat what's made for you and made with you. And then there's this two-way street. You know, there's a two-way acculturation. And then what happens is when enslaved Africans and native people get their hands on the foods of others, they're incorporating them into a social and cultural context that is not European.
So these foods that you – I don't even know what those four foods that you mentioned that come from Europe are. I have no clue. Do you know what they are?
Chef Matthew is getting excited over here.
what are they?
So skirret is a root.
Okay.
Cardoon is in the same family as artichokes and celery. Medlars are fruit. And these are the kind of things that everyday medieval and Tudor English people would have eaten on a regular basis.
So
we never made it to the South.
So these things were not available here, natively available here. But I would think that the other foods that you mentioned, why would the Africans have known about these foods? In other words, were these new to them too when they knew about them?
By the time the bulk of my ancestors showed up in the mid-18th century, they had corn and other New World foods for almost as long as there's been in America. So just think about that. These foods show up almost immediately within 10 years of Columbus's voyage to West Africa.
Okay.
Okay, so within 15, 20 years.
But not to Europe.
But very seldom. So corn was in Europe. And other crops had sort of turkey had migrated. And sweet potatoes. But, you know, it was kind of like so exotic. It was like nothing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, think about this. By the 17th century, China's full of sweet potatoes. They didn't know where the hell they came from. And said, oh, look at this. Mm-hmm. This new food. Isn't this great? Mm-hmm. They had no idea that the Portuguese and through other people had come to China. So in West Africa, by the time Africans show up to these North Carolina and Virginia plantations, South Carolina, et cetera, the foods from the Americas and from tropical Asia had been several thousand years. But from the Americas, those foods had been there as long as we have been in an independent America. I want you to really grasp that. Mm-hmm. So we think of 1776 as a long time ago, right? Declaration of Independence. That's how long the foods had been in Africa. So they had 2.5 centuries to make these foods indigenous.
And to know how to use them.
And to know how to use them.
Yeah. You write, the enslaved the palate of those who enslaved them. What a great sentence. Unpack that. Is that to say that the enslaved basically called the shots?
Yeah.
When it came to food.
I mean, it's something to let somebody who you have in chains make your food every day. That's a deep, that's a weird and deep and intimate and Freudian thing to have, you know, these people who you have in bondage do all the cooking and, you know, sort of entrust your calories to them, that they won't kill you, first of all. And then second of all, that you can actually, you acclimate yourself to their food ways. And what I think really happened was, at the very beginning, we have this dominance of British Isles cuisine, German, French influences. And then you have these Creole generations. So the black kids are eating the white food, and the white kids are eating the black food, and it all gets mixed together.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Michael Twitty, then Kathleen Purvis and Chef Matthew Prince will also join us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details on the Subaru Share the Love event at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. And Taylor Richards and Conger, a specialty shop for men built and headquartered in Charlotte, featuring European and American tailored clothing and accessories. Phillips Place next to Dean and DeLuca. Details at TRCStyle.com. Well, all about a place ordinary North Carolinians love to visit, but a place built for the high and mighty. That's the topic on this program tomorrow. All about Biltmore House It's Fascinating History at 9. And the conversation on Southern food continues in the next episode of WFAE's podcast Southbound with Tommy Tomlinson. He talks with John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, about the powerful history of Southern food. And that episode goes online tomorrow at WFAE.org and iTunes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Rex Tillerson, State Department. Diplomats pushed out, empty desks, morale rock bottom. Is American diplomacy in free fall? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for that conversation on Point from 10 till noon, following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Michael Twitty, blogger, culinary cultural historian, and the author of The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. Also with us in our studio, Kathleen Purvis, the food editor for the Charlotte Observer, and Chef Matthew Krenz, executive chef at the Asbury, which is in the Dunhill Hotel, and he is cooking tonight. We're having a dinner tonight, at least, to open to people who have already made reservations at the Asbury. Kathleen, you wrote a column about mac and cheese recently in which you referenced having to speak to a school class about your job. Mm-hmm. And you did a middle school version, you say, of tell me what you eat and I'll tell you who you are. So if we are what we eat, who are Southerners?
We are a very, very complicated people. I think that the outside world often wants to paint us with one sort of monochromatic South, and that is not the South. The South is a huge variety of people, regions, geographies, history. We are the tossed salad, as Tom Hanchett likes to say around here, where it's not a melting pot here, it's a salad, where we all bring different things to it. And, you know, that's what part of what makes my job so much fun and so endlessly interesting is that people have these very strong emotions about their part of the story. And it gets very heated when I write these stories. I did one last year on cornbread. Michael is laughing at me because I interviewed him for it. Did this one on macaroni and cheese. I've written about pimento cheese. People get really heated about these things. And that's part of what makes it so much fun.
Okay.
Was that a clear answer?
Yeah, I think so. Your restaurant, Matthew, the Asbury in the Dunhill, features what you call modern Southern cuisine that honors the past. So Southern cuisine is more than the meat and three that we used to have all over town, these meat and three restaurants. It's certainly more than fried chicken. It's certainly more than cornbread. How do you honor the past and make it modern at the same time? And then what is it if it's modern Southern food?
We acknowledge the things that have taken shape and where we've gotten in food today. We're using indigenous ingredients and ingredients that were readily available to everybody. The food that speaks to us is Southern food. I mean, it's so steeped in tradition, and you know, it was brought here and traveled many borders to get to where we are now. And the meat and three was a fad, you know. Where we are now is textures, ingredients, diversity, and the things that have shaped us to where we are.
I read about you, and you added something called cornbread kush to the menu at the Asbury and told the servers there to explain to people eating in the restaurant that this recipe was on your menu to honor slave contributions to food. And you got that recipe from Michael Twitty over here. What is cornbread kush?
Cornbread kush is the ancestor to cornbread dressing. And last year I was listening to him speak and so moved by not only the way that he spoke to people, how passionate he was about what he spoke about, but the educational aspect. And this was a way that I felt like I could acknowledge his research and the things that he's done. And it was important for me to help spread that word and get his voice heard by other people that maybe might not have had open ears. Mm-hmm. And you know, just trying to help do what I can, what little I can.
Where's home base for you, Michael?
The D.C. area.
Okay, so you all three know each other.
Mm-hmm.
How do you all three know each other? Obviously, you've seen him speak, and he's going to be with you tonight at the Asbury, and you'll be doing this dinner together, and you know about his writing. I guess he knows about yours. How do you all know each other?
Well, food writing is a small world. It truly is. There's a very tight-knit group of us who know each other very, very well, and we have common friends, and we belong to the same organizations. Michael and I are both members of the Southern Foodways Alliance. We've all been involved in the James Beard Foundation. I do a lot of work for them.
Why is there no Northern Foodways?
Because there ain't no Northern food.
Oh, that's not true. And there is John T. Edge has worked with. There is a Midwestern Foodways Alliance that has started. There are New England organizations around food. Southern Foodways is the most visible and best organized.
Well, there's that. But I also think that, as I've joked with lots of my audiences, name me a New England restaurant and Red Lobster don't count.
Legal seafood.
Legal seafood.
Name me a Southwestern restaurant and Chipotle don't count.
Pizza Bianco.
Name me a Midwestern restaurant and Perkins don't count. It's just like, nah, there's no Pacific Northwest. There's no, there's no like pancake chain out that way. But old jokes aside, Cracker Barrel is one of the leading food chains.
Mm-hmm.
There are multiple fast food restaurants nationwide, international, that are built on, a rough idea, I'll put it like that, of Southern food. There are gourmet restaurants and mom and pops and meet and threes that are all over the place. Southern food ideas have made their way into barbecue restaurants across the country, et cetera, even though they all usually do it wrong. The bottom line is that this is a billion-dollar industry. Nobody else in the country has such it's the oldest and most articulated American cuisine.
Well, I was going to say, can you say then that Southern food is American food? It's just plain, it is our American.
Absolutely.
Italians have Italian food. This is American food.
It is the ultimate American food, and I think we also tend to forget that it's not landlocked. Mm-hmm. So that what Kathleen said earlier is very important, because Southerners didn't just land and stay; they always kept moving. And so people don't realize that there is an urge for Southern food in places like Detroit, where white and black Southerners went en masse, in Cincinnati.
But isn't that called soul?
Chicago.
Very important.
All the way to California with people who came from Arkansas and Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl. Okay. People who went up the Texas Trail into the Rocky Mountains were former Southerners.
The Great Migration, before civil rights, so many African Americans left the South for more opportunity, took their food with them, and did the best job they could in creating it in very distant places. The other thing that I think people bring up a lot when I write about Southern food, and they sometimes get a bit defensive about this, is that Southern food at its roots is rural food.
Mm.
What we think of Southern food today, the sort of popular culture attitude of it, is basically farm food. And there were farms all over this country. So if I talk to a friend whose family had a farm in Indiana, she'll point out the foods that they made that are not, they don't think of them as Southern food. They think of them as rural food, as farm food. Same thing. They're very closely related.
Well, have we appropriated it then? Have we just?
Probably a bit. Yeah. I think we have to be open to the idea that a lot of Americans take things that they can relate to and that taste good to them, and they adapt them. And that's
happened
here. Because
macaroni and cheese, to use your example, is everywhere.
Well, it is, but it is in a different cultural meaning.
Right.
One of the things I ended up doing last Wednesday, I had taken the day off to start prepping my Thanksgiving dinner, and I had to drop everything, stand there in my kitchen, and do a live radio talk show in Nebraska, where the guy had heard about macaroni and cheese being used as a side dish at Thanksgiving tables, and he was stunned because he'd never thought of it as anything but a main dish, a weekday thing, never a holiday dish. And I'm sitting here on the phone trying to explain to a guy in Nebraska why we consider it a side dish, why it's a celebratory food here, and having to, 5 minutes to fill in that history.
and there's no such thing as black Thanksgiving anywhere without macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And you'd be amazed at the number of people who've called me names and called me out over the last 5 days since that story ran. How dare you say this? I have had people tell me it's racist drivel. I've had people use the phrase pure fiction, what you wrote. You know, I mean, things like that. People who don't have that cultural understanding truly cannot relate to
pure fiction, meaning what?
That I made it up.
That you made.
You mean what up?
That I made it up for Black Thanksgiving it's different. That I made this up. Out of whole cloth.
Hey, everybody, listen. There's a real Black person in the studio right now saying, Kathleen did not write racist drivel. Black Thanksgiving is different. You need things to be Black Thanksgiving approved.
What's on the menu?
Oh, shoot. First of all, macaroni and cheese, collard greens, a deep fried or barbecue turkey. Maybe roasted, but we've been moving more towards the deep fried and the barbecue turkey.
Yeah.
You need to have sweet potatoes. First of all, we don't do pumpkin pie. Forget that. Sweet potato pie only. We don't do parsnips. We don't do none of that. Our macaroni and cheese has to be orange. You see white macaroni and cheese? It has, you know, paprika, the most yellow cheddar of the cheddar you can get in there.
Mm-hmm. A little Velveeta for smoothness.
See? Talk about it. Give me a fist bump. Talk about it. Preach. Preach the gospel.
Michael did a really great piece. Was it for the Washington Post?
Yeah.
On Black Thanksgiving. That is absolutely perfect and hilarious. And yes, I read it while I was doing the reporting.
So it's different.
When you talk about Southern food being American food, your South is actually more expansive than most people,
yes.
I think of the South as being. You have added states like Maryland.
Oh, absolutely.
Florida, Texas, and Oklahoma.
Oh, absolutely.
Why add those to Virginia, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi?
Because people have to realize something. The people who became Kentuckians and Missourians and who became Tennesseans, those were Marylanders and Virginians who ran out of the land.
And Pennsylvanians,
yeah, too.
Yeah.
They ran out of land. People who came down the Great Wagon Road to Appalachia all started off at the Port of Philadelphia. They were Scots-Irish. So we have to realize that, you know, when Frederick Douglass talks about growing up on a 500-person plantation, he's talking about Maryland. You know, Harriet Tubman was from Mississippi. She was from Maryland. You know, Benjamin Banneker was from Maryland. Okay, the center of the Black population in the 18th century was the Chesapeake Bay. It wasn't some down-home location.
And the reason Maryland didn't secede was that Abraham Lincoln he threatened to burn down Baltimore
thank God I wouldn't be sitting here talking, because he locked up the legislature, because Roger B. Taney was leading it. He was Mr. Three-Fifths of a Person, Dred Scott. And so had he not done that, among other maneuvers. And also I want to put this out there. There is no grits line. There is no sweet tea line. That's all total nonsense. Complete nonsense. But what there is.
Wait a minute. What do you mean there's no sweet tea?
There's no sweet tea line. That's nonsense.
Try to get sweet tea in New Jersey.
But you can now. That's been a thing for 20 years. But watch this. All those cities that we call border cities or the border South really has nothing to do with geography. It has to do with migration and immigration patterns.
Okay.
When the Irish and Germans come in between 1820 and 1860, their game is not to become part of the planter class. The Irish, for example, resent having to compete with other immigrants and with enslaved Black people. The Germans want no part of slavery. So if you've noticed, Baltimore, draw a line across to Louisville, go down to St. Louis, and then follow it down to Austin, Texas. What do you know about all those cities? All heavily German, heavily Irish between 1820s and 1840s. And any settlement where they went to in the South were the parts of the South during the Civil War that essentially tried to set up free republics that seceded from the secession. So this monolithic South, where it's defined by the Confederacy, isn't the total reality. Because you're the same country ham in St. Mary's County, the same country ham in East Kentucky, the same country ham in the New Dixie of Missouri.
So when you bring in these other influences, the German influences and the Irish influences, mm-hmm. and they spread throughout this South, and you include Texas and Oklahoma in your South and mm-hmm. Florida, surely the Southern food in those states is different than the Southern food in Alabama or South Carolina.
To a certain extent, but if you go to Northeast Texas, it's the same Upper South food. It's the same thing. The same beaten biscuits, the same cathead biscuits, the same country ham, the same turnip greens, the same fried chicken. And that's the most amazing part. The lower South is a little bit different because you have the Gulf Coast and the low country sort of competing for how – and sometimes they merge in some parts of the lower South, but not really. And then you have the influence in the Caribbean as well.
Right.
There's the Caribbean, the Gulf, and the Lowcountry. But there's this completely what amazes me is that there's this completely unified Upper South food culture, and it's huge swath of this country. So for somebody to have chicken fried steak, for example, or chicken fried anything, and gravy and some biscuits, that's the national food of like. What, 13 different states? I mean, and that's really impressive for a country that is this big, mm-hmm. for that food tradition to be that wide.
Matthew, you've lived both in North Carolina and Texas, if I'm not mistaken. How would you describe the differences in the food in both – the southern food in both of those places?
Sure. So when I lived in Texas, there were obvious Latin influences, but those were the Latin restaurants. And mm-hmm. the southern places – you nailed it with the country fried steak, gravy, and mashed potatoes. Oh boy, you can make a couple of meals out of that down there. And everything is bigger in Texas. Yeah.
What part of Texas?
I lived in Houston.
Okay, so you were
that's big.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Very different. I mean, Texas always surprises me because it's sort of like one side of Texas is deep south and the other side is really more western. So it's sort of like, how do you place Texas and
right.
its food?
Yeah, and the southern food is. It sticks to its roots, you know, and the food down there and the food here are mirrors of each other.
Hmm. This book, Michael, is an outgrowth of your personal search, I understand,
yep.
for your roots. And you say in 2011 that you had started to, this is a quote, forget where you came from. And you started a crowdfunded campaign called the Southern Discomfort Tour. What was that tour all about and why the title?
I just feel like people tend to forget that what we enjoy comes at a cost. I mean, that's the big conversation about Thanksgiving this year was basically, don't forget this came at a tremendous human cost. This isn't just some people showed up for a nice, you know, meal and everything was great. No. Things went downhill pretty fast. And so in the same way, Southern food is yeoman farmers struggling. It's enslaved Africans and free people of color struggling for equality. It's Native people who have been disenfranchised. It's Chinese Americans who come here to work on cotton plantations as tenant farmers, sharecroppers, and little store owners in Mississippi who have essentially become very much assimilated into the Southern culture. It's the story of there have been Mexicans and Latino people and Filipinos in the South for 300 years. They didn't just show up yesterday. Hmm. They've always been there. They've always been there. There have always been Muslims in the South. In fact, there were more Muslims in the South than any other part of the country in the year 1750. I mean, all the people from West Africa who came from Senegal and Gambia and Mali, yeah. So, and then people who came from Turkey and other parts who get kind of like stranded in the South. These people exist. These people exist. So for me to look at my own genetic record and see that so many of those people were in there, mm. there's the Middle Eastern, there's Southeast Asian, there's African, there's Native, there's European, really sort of brought home for me that we really embody this history.
Michael Twitting is our guest, along with Kathleen Purvis from The Observer and Chef Matthew Krentz from The Asbury. The Cooking Gene is the name of Michael's book. We'll come back and talk more about that and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Central Piedmont Community College's Small Business Center, offering grant writing classes to find grant resources and write effective proposals. Starting December the 6th, cpcc.edu/sbc. And Rinalda House Museum of American Art, marking 100 years with Centennial Christmas at Rinalda. Historic decorations, caroling Fridays, and special tours. Details at rinaldahouse.org/holidays. The State Department is in turmoil. Morale has hit rock bottom. Diplomats have been pushed out. Budgets have been cut, leaving a lot of empty desks in that part of Washington known as Foggy Bottom. Former Ambassador Nicholas Burns calls the president's dismissive attitude toward diplomacy a crisis, and he will join Tom Ashbrook in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock to talk about all of that and more during On Point, and we will continue our conversation on food and Southern food and history of Southern food in just a moment.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
There is clarity in Kenya this morning about that country's leadership.
Clarity, at least according to the country's Supreme Court.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
About 50 people attended the forum at Little Rock AME Zion Church in uptown Charlotte. Kristen Williams said police body cams were supposed...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Southern food with Michael Twitty, a blogger. What did I say you were called? One of the 20 greatest food bloggers of all time. Southern Living says he's one of the 50 people who is changing the South. He's also the author of The Cooking Gene, a journey through African-American culinary history in the Old South. He's here along with Chef Matthew Krenz of the Asbury, executive chef there, with whom, I guess, are the two of you cooking tonight? Or are you just attending the dinner that Matthew is cooking tonight?
I'm going to let him cook. Okay.
No, Michael and I actually were able to kind of connect, and I was able to get a little bit more instruction on some of the techniques and the ingredients and the things that would have traditionally been prepared. And, you know, he came up with a beautiful menu and reached out to some local farmers that are raising beautiful products. And
so what's on the menu?
We've got Madeira ham, and it's roasting away as we speak, actually.
Is that ham and Madeira wine? Is that what that is?
Madeira wine. There's ale. There's orange. There's lemon. There's kitchen pepper on there. It sat in a brine overnight, and it's basted throughout the process and slow roasted. And then we're doing poisson. We got young chickens, and we're going to roast those. It's sorghum brined, and we're going to roast those in cabbage. We've got cornbread kush. Some of it's going to be cooked with leftover ham that we had from Thanksgiving. Some of it's going to be just vegetarian because, again, that is what Michael speaks to. Those were the things that were available in the kitchen to the people cooking. And a lot of times those were the foods that they would be left with, the leftovers.
As you're sitting here talking about some of these things, and you're talking about leftovers, and you're talking about the Asbury, and I know that isn't cheap. So when you're serving really authentic Southern food that you would have gotten in a farmhouse kitchen or a plantation kitchen or at the dinner table in those places, how do you justify? I don't know how to ask this question politely, but how do you justify charging what people charge in restaurants for that food?
Well, a lot of it is local. Can I jump in
sure,
quickly?
Please.
A lot of it is locally raised, and our locally raised farmers, our local farmers, deserve to be paid for their work. They're doing something that takes a lot of sacrifice and risk to raise these things. I do not want to tell you on the radio what I paid for a local turkey recently. It was kind of an obscene amount of money. But at the same time, I recognize that the person who raised those turkeys it's very hard to raise turkeys. You lose them easily. You're going to turn a profit on what you do. You deserve to be paid for it. Also, that plantation table you just mentioned in the dining room oftentimes had some pretty expensive imported ingredients that the wealthy could afford to bring in.
Okay.
So Madeira was not cheap. Madeira went all the way around the planet on a ship to become Madeira. your Madeira was precious. So these ingredients are not necessarily as
mundane.
As mundane as we think they
it's
are.
A quality
is that
issue.
Fair?
Absolutely.
Take it from here.
And
Michael.
One other thing, and this is one thing that stood out to me when I listened to his speech last year. Mm-hmm. Michael said, "This was not the food that they ate every day. This was a special occasion." And that one stuck with me because, you know, we're sitting there eating greens and we're eating cornbread kush, which is, you know, the ancestor to dressing and fried chicken and rolls and biscuits and things like that we consider everyday foods, you know. And to hear how passionate he was about this was not eaten every day by the enslaved Americans.
Why did you decide to take the Asbury in this direction?
Because that is our roots. I mean, we call ourselves a Southern restaurant, modern Southern restaurant. We need to stay true to Southern cuisine.
But you could have been anything. You could have been any kind of restaurant. Why choose that?
Well, Chef Chris Coleman actually pointed it in the southern direction. Mm-hmm. I took over after he left.
Okay.
And so from that, I decided to start educating myself on the roots of southern cuisine.
So this is somewhat, not completely, but somewhat new for you. You're actually learning as you're going? Bringing new things to the table?
Everybody's learning as they're going. If they're telling you different, they're lying to you.
Right.
But basically, I grew up around farms, near farms, picking fruits, vegetables. We raise beef cattle on my family farm out in New Salem in Union County. So southern food and farm food is definitely been in my family for a long time. But educating myself on the roots of southern food and the influences of southern food, that's something that's still very new to me.
I want to take this conversation away from food for just a second here, because you did this Southern discomfort tour, in which I guess you are confronting things about the South and our history and our mm-hmm. food history that are uncomfortable to some people. And one of the things people who are returning to the South or maybe coming here for the first time will notice, aside from the topography, are other artifacts of the Old South that we're still having debates about. You say, in some town center, the auction blocks are remembered. From the town I live in Maryland, to Oxford, Mississippi, the Confederate soldier stands guard near the old courthouse, and people will point out to you where the hanging tree stood mm-hmm. or stands. Well, right now, we are engaged in this great debate about what to do with some of those things. And I know your book is about food and about bringing right. people together, but some of these things tear people apart. What's your take on what should happen to some of these southern artifacts?
Okay, so a couple different things. One, I've noticed that we have to stand guard against people who don't have this history and this legacy and this heritage coming in to exacerbate old wounds. For example, in the Virginia race, you had Corey Stewart of Minnesota and Ed Gillespie of New Jersey, both coming in trying to gain political and personal power based on ripping off a bandage to rip off a scab to dig into a wound that they had nothing to do with. You know, when you are, I'm a descendant of several Confederate veterans. I'm also black. I also share that heritage with thousands of white Southerners who are my cousins. And thousands of black Southerners and black people who are my cousins. You in my family business when you come down here talking about, I'll keep your statues and, you know, revving up, you know, all this excitement over what amounts to really cheap metal. That cheap metal is never more important than people. And I think that's where we get, you know, kind of off the rails. And the bottom line is we've had a lot of people who have, I won't say certain names, who have preyed upon those old divisions in the South, and have used them against us. The Southern people, as I write in my book, are a family. We're a dysfunctional as hell family, but we're still a family. And the bottom line is that we're not going to get anywhere haggling over statues when we have real systemic issues to deal with. I'm not about symbolics. I'm about systemics. I'm about talking about questions of housing fairness and redlining. In education.
But aren't those statues symbols of those systemic problems?
Those statues are just statues. You know, I don't know why the one verse in the Bible that doesn't get noticed is thou shalt not make any graven images. Apparently that got swept over because, you know, two dudes got to get married. And I'm one of those two dudes that gets married. So I'd rather you not have this idolatry about these images that were put up during Jim Crow. I used to think they were about white Southern trauma, which I understand,
mm-hmm.
because these were children and teenagers who were drafted into a war, and I can understand that kind of military and societal trauma, but. When my personal opinion started to change is when I found out that, no, these were part of a lost cause, you know, tradition that emerged long after. Because like most people who endured military event trauma, they weren't really about remembering it. They wanted to get as far away from it as possible. Because
well, these
they
statues were put up during the time of Jim Crow.
Yeah. This is not the Southern PTSD. This is more like defiance against the rising tide of equality. And this is where I have the problem. I have no problem with something that sort of, you know, honors the memory of the people who served in the Confederacy, who died, because everybody has a right to memorialize their dead. But when it comes down to, we want to maintain this veneer, this culture of defiance against the actualization of the American dream, that's when we have words with each other.
So I'm still having trouble understanding how you come. Seem to be fairly, you see these statues as being fairly benign and off topic, off target.
I find that to be irrelevant.
But why? I mean, you have feet in both camps, and you've just said that these things were erected by people who were trying to defy.
Yeah.
What happened as a result of the Civil War? They were not in my backyard. You're not. That's essentially what those statues were saying at the time. That's what they were meant to say. So why is that not something you want to see gone?
I don't think it's the most important thing.
Okay.
I think it's far more important for all white Southerners to realize how African they are than they're the most African people in America. Having been to Nigeria, having been to Senegal, on my way to Ghana, I promise you, there is nobody more African than a white Southerner.
Cal emails, a few years ago, my wife and I were in Nairobi, Kenya, Fairmont Hotel. I looked through the in-house magazine and saw an article about the executive chef for all East African Fairmont hotels. To my surprise, he was from North Carolina and spoke about the similarities between Southern and African cuisines.
Yes. 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 How on time is that? When you go to Senegal and Nigeria, and I've been to England, I've been to France, I've been to Scotland, I've been to Ireland, I've been to Denmark. And then you go to West Africa, Senegal and Nigeria, and you see millions of pods of okra, black-eyed peas, watermelon, rice, hot peppers, hot wheelbarrows full of hot pepper, hot sauce everywhere. There's a barbecue man, woman on every single corner in Dakar and Lagos. Barbecuing fish, chicken, pork, beef, lamb, all of it, goat. When you see the chickens frying before they put into the stew, and then you think, oh, wow, chicken and gravy, and da-da. When you see people, everybody sops. Everybody sops.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's
sopping mean you're
yeah. Whether it's in the South, it's a biscuit. In West Africa, it's fufu. The fact of the matter is, you know, even in Nigeria, we saw corn fritters in a ball with onion. What do you call that? Fried up, a hush puppy.
Mm-hmm.
In New Orleans, kala was rice fried up in a ball. They did black-eyed pea fritters in Virginia, South Carolina, and Louisiana. They call us akara in Nigeria, akaraje in Brazil. So this. It's like it hits you when you're in the, you know, we were dancing in this village. By the way, when I went to Nigeria, it was with 9 other African Americans who had traced their DNA back to the Igbo and Yoruba people in southern Nigeria. So when we were in the village, we were being welcomed back home. And when we did the, you know, inevitably there'd be drums. And we were expected to dance along. It wasn't like you just watch people dance. It was completely New Orleans second line. You know, everybody, and you go through the entire city dancing for miles, just expected to like, everybody comes out and dances with you. So, you know, I mean it. The South represents not only this black folks are picking up European culture and native culture, but the most Africanized white people in America. Mm. And that is the greatest irony, that the same folks who, you know, are getting up in arms and waving flags and, you know, standing in front of these statues are the same people who, if you took them to Nigeria, would be more at home than if you took them to England.
Hmm. You have made a habit of getting up early in the morning in places, putting on long, rough trousers, maybe some woolen socks, maybe cotton socks, doesn't matter, I suppose. Long shirt that you barely wash, full of tears and rips, you say.
Mm-hmm.
A waistcoat and a kerchief. And you talk about cooking in these old plantation kitchens and the smell of the fire and the wood permeating your clothes and into your hair follicles. It's so deeply ingrained.
Yeah, it's really not sexy. People want to, like, come to you because you smell like bacon.
And you write about singing the song quoted by a formerly enslaved person to the WPA. This is back in the Depression. That includes the N-word. And you say that song gives you an undefinable phantom pleasure. You have immersed yourself into the life of a slave to cook the way he had to cook for the master.
Right.
Why does that give you pleasure?
Because the ancestors are being brought back to life and honored. You know, a lot of times when I would go to plantations like Somerset Place or Stagville or Latta, I've cooked at all three, you would go there and all of a sudden you would go, you would walk into the property and you'd feel this tremendous sadness. The, you know, our golf courses, our condos, our gated communities, our parking lots are over the bodies of thousands of black people in unmarked graves. Tremendous sadness because they've been forgotten. One of the worst things in African spirituality that can happen to you is to be a forgotten ancestor. So when I go there and I start singing that song, cold and frosty morning, the folks is feeling good. Take the axe upon your shoulder and talk to the wood. I'm sitting there and they're waking up. They're like, okay. And there's been lots of times when I'll go into a place and I have very strange experiences and weird stuff happens. But if I've done a good job and I leave, there's this tremendous feeling of release. I can't describe it to you. And it's not personal. It's spiritual. It's in the air. It's like, thank you for not letting us be forgotten. Mm. We're still here. We're not just here spiritually, but we're in your bodies. We're in your spirit. We're in your food. We're in everything. We're in the trees. We're in the remnants of these cabins. And the feeling that I have enabled more of our ancestors to not be forgotten, not only not be forgotten, but be celebrated and for their lives to be called out. Every time another African-American says, you know something, I did my genealogy because of you, and now I know the name of my great-great-great-grandmother. It's like we're rescuing our ancestors from a generic cultural amnesia.
Wow. Michael Twitty, blogger and the author of The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. We don't have time to talk about your great-great-grandfather and his brother being among the first slaves to know the South had lost the war. But
they were free, most of all.
That's right. We'll leave that for another day. Kathleen Purvis and Chef Matthew Krentz also with us. Thank you all for the hour.